All right. Well, thank you, and thanks very much for the invitation. It's been fantastic to be able to be here and learn so much about these topics from the experts. I've had a great time. What I want to talk about, well, as Anne said, the title is SLN Hat: Crystals, Fusion Rules, and Quantum Schubert Calculus, which probably sounds like a very generic title for this workshop, and in some sense it is. A lot of what I want to talk about is in some sense expository, in that it's been known to various experts for a long time. I will, of course, mention some things which are my own work, and I'll start with some crystal stuff which is mine. But you know, this event is called a workshop, and I decided it would, you know, be better to do some work that would help further my knowledge and other people's knowledge than to try and stick some original work I've done that doesn't quite fit with this conference and make you listen to that. So that's what I've done. And now I'm slightly nervous because I realize that the people who actually did the work are mostly in the audience, and I don't actually quite remember the exact credits for everyone who's worked on this. So if I state one of your theorems and forget to mention your name, feel free to interrupt me. And in fact, in general, feel free to interrupt me a lot. I like being interrupted. So, how's this going to go? Well, there's sort of going to be two parts. Part one is going to be essentially crystals. And I'm going to start by actually just talking about crystals in general very briefly. There's been quite a few talks in this conference that have been related to crystals, but I haven't really seen anyone introduce them so much, and I think there's probably a few people in the audience who can benefit from that, so I will do it. And if you're not one of the people who can benefit, feel free not to listen. And then I'm going to talk about, I mean, so this is very general. It works in, you know, the generality of symmetrizable Kac-Moody algebras and highest weight. I mean, it's very, very general. But then I'm going to get into the specifics of SLN hat. And in particular, I'm going to talk about the abacus / cylindric model. So this is a combinatorial way of realizing these crystals, which I wrote about essentially in my thesis, although it's extremely related to work of Jimbo Mizomiro-Okado and also of Foda, Leclerc, Okado, Thibon, and Welsh. So while the statements I'm going to give are my original work, those people deserve some credit. But then when we do this, we're going to see some things happen. So we're going to see that highest weight elements look like, well, at least some of the highest weight elements are going to look like partitions in a, n minus 1 by L box, which should start to remind you of, well, I mean, you should have already been reminded of quantum cohomology if you know this picture, but this looks like, well, okay, so this is SLN hat highest weight vectors, but somehow we're going to see that maybe sometimes we want to think about GLN hat instead of SLN hat, and then these look like shifts of partitions in box. So essentially what I mean by that is a basis element here, I mean, an element here looks like a choice of a partition and some power of some variable, which you should think of as having degree, well, either N or L, whichever one makes it work out in the end. And so these are actually exactly going to be, these highest weight elements are going to exactly look like a Z basis for quantum cohomology of, well, the variety of flags of, Grassmannian of L planes in N plus L space. So that's somehow, we're going to start to see that. And also sort of as a slightly neat application, although we're going to be able to calculate some fusion. And in particular, we're going to be able to calculate the ones that come from taking the fusion product of an arbitrary highest weight representation with something that looks like, well, a rectangle. And this is not very hard, and it's due to, Mark Shimazona gave me the reference for this the other day. It's in a paper of Foda, Leclerc, Okado, and Tibon from quite a while ago, but maybe it's news to at least someone here, that if you want to calculate these fusion rules, which are these K Littlewood-Richardson coefficients, and one of the things you're multiplying together is a rectangle, then they're actually easy. But the other ones, of course, are extremely hard, and this won't generalize, essentially because I'm using the fact that there is a crystal basis for a Kirilov-Rashtikhin module, and that doesn't generalize. So that's part one. Part two is going to be shorter, probably. Well, part two, I've always been confused by this fusion product. And another thing I've been confused about was, there's all these statements saying that this fusion algebra is the same as the quantum cohomology. If you read back the old papers, like Witten just says, this fusion algebra and this quantum cohomology are the same. And then I was reading recent paper of Katerina Stropel and Christian Korff, and, first of all, they don't say that they're the same. They say that the fusion ring is a quotient of the quantum cohomology. And I asked Katerina about this, and she insisted that it wasn't somehow mathematically precise the way Witten did it, which is believable, but I claim it can be made mathematically precise. And I think there are people in the room who know how to make it mathematically precise, because I think I've found the statements in some of the Pont and Morris papers. But still, I will talk about that. So here, the way I'm going to make it precise, though, is perhaps different. I'm going to talk about this fusion ring of level L for SLN. Maybe it's hat. I don't know if I should use hat in this notation. As a semi-simplified ring of U epsilon L N, and sometimes I'm going to do GLN, where epsilon to some power is 1. And it's well known, it's work of Finkelberg using other work of Preston and Lustig, that these are the same. So this is usually defined using some vertex operator construction, but you get the same fusion ring. And there I just find it easy to calculate, and it's sort of easy to make it well-defined what you mean when you replace SLN with GLN, and it's easy to see that you get the isomorphism you want. And so see that fusion ring of little L of GLN is exactly the same as this quantum cohomology ring. Okay, so that's my plan. So, crystals, very quickly. And I will do this the way I always do, which is simply to write one example and tell you it very vastly generalizes. And the example is always SL3, and the highest weight representation, omega 1 plus omega 2, which is also known as the adjoint representation. Everyone probably knows SL3 contains sort of some special elements, which are the things which are zero everywhere except just above or just below the diagonal. So the ones people call E are just above. And you normally break representations into weight spaces, which are the same thing as the simultaneous eigenspaces of the diagonal matrices acting on this. And this particular representation is 8-dimensional, and you usually break it into 7 weight spaces, which you normally draw, this one's not very close to the center, in a pattern like this. So There are 6 one-dimensional ones and 1 two-dimensional one. And then you usually notice that the, so I'm going to draw in some arrows for these FIs. So you notice that F1, I mean, they're drawn in this sort of configuration for a reason, and one way to see that reason is F1 always takes you in one direction like this, and F2 always takes you in some other direction like this. Okay? And so then you look at this picture, and it's very tempted to say, something like, well, this representation pretty much looks like a color-directed graph, which, if you're a combinatorialist, is a great thing. But, of course, there's a problem, which is in the middle here. Well, I mean, there's maybe more problems, but at very least, in the middle here, there's two-dimensional space, and there are sort of 4 distinguished one-dimensional subspaces, which is the images of these two maps and the kernels of these two maps. And they're really all different, so it's really impossible to do this. Then Kashiwara fixed this problem, and the fix is you replace SL3 with the quantum group. You replace each FI with something called FI tilde, which is some sort of slightly strange renormalization of this. You let Q go to, well, I for some reason let Q go to infinity. Some people let Q go to 0. And then it works. Then FI tilde are partial permutations of some once you interpret what all this means correctly, there is something called the crystal basis, and these things are just partial permutations. And so you erase this. You put in some nodes here. And you're very happy. And then this works in great generality. So you're very happy in great generality. But then the next thing you want to do if you're a combinatorialist is you start wanting to say, well, okay, this representation now is, I mean, it's actually characterized by this graph. So how can I find this graph without doing any work and without actually understanding representation theory? In many, many cases, this is known. And in this case, what you do is you replace the nodes with semi-standard Young tableau. And so in this particular example, we're looking at this shape. And in this middle node, you would see, that's a 2 and that's a 3. You probably can't read this anyway. But you see the two semi-standard fillings of this shape with 1, 2, and 3. And you see all the other semi-standard fillings around the outside. OK. I'm sure this is a review for almost everyone. But so be it. I actually want to use this board for now. All right, so now we want to do, you might want to do any other case you like, and there's combinatorial models for all kinds of these graphs, but I want to do this case, so SLN hat, which is the subject of a lot of work at this conference. So, there are many answers. People have published various answers to this. Here's an answer. So the nodes, meaning the vertices in the graph, are going to be things I call this. And this is configurations of beads on the same abacus, essentially, that has come up in this conference before, only I'm going to be a little bit, annoying and draw it at a new angle. I'm also not, because some people seem to like to put numbers instead of beads, but I'm just going to put beads and holes. So it's a bead, a hole, a bead. I'll explain what this picture is supposed to mean if you don't know in a second. Okay, so what example I'm doing? I'm going to do SL3 and a representation of level 4. So level 4, because it's level 4, I'm drawing 4 rows of beads. That's a 4 abacus. That's just the rule. Where did I put the paint chalk? And then I'm going to color, well, I'm going to color the gaps between the beads is somehow the best way to do it. So this, I'm going to color very strong to say this is like the origin, but in particular, it's 0. And then I'm going to cyclically color 1, 2, 0, 1, and so on. So all right, so now these are colored. And, I mean, essentially, I just need to tell you the rule for what the FIs do. So I'm going to tell you what F2 does. And what you do is you start reading from left to right and going up. Huh. So far, no restrictions. There will, of course, be restrictions. Well, first notice that I didn't color this cyclically. Yeah, so it's actually with no restrictions at all, the thing, starting with any node, just look at what it generates, you will get a crystal for SLN hat, like a valid crystal for representation. But of course, it's an enormous crystal with lots of parts, so for that reason, I'm going to want restrictions. So now, I still don't have it cyclically colored. Now I think it's cyclically colored. Now I can safely calculate F2. What I should do is start reading up these two colored strands, looking for places a bead could move forward, which, you know, if, you know, for people who did this, I'm curious, you might want to think of as adding a 4 ribbon to some partition or something like that. So here's one. I put an open bracket. This row is very, this column is very complicated. One can move forward, one can move back, and then two more can move forward. So I put an open bracket, close, open, open. Open, close, open. You cancel the brackets, you move the bead corresponding to the first bracket. So F2, if I apply it once, I would move this bead. If I try and apply it again, if I don't move this one because this bracket cancels, I would move this bead. If I apply F2 a third time, I would do this. Fourth time, I would do this. And the fifth time, I would kill the configuration. It would get sent to 0. So I would fall off the end of one of these strings. All right, great. So theorem, as I already said, is that starting with any configuration, of course, to be a valid configuration, it should have all beads on one side and all blanks on the other side, I guess. You always impose that condition, right? But no other conditions. You get a highest weight crystal, so the crystal of some highest weight representation of SL3 of level L, which in this case is 4. All right, and so now the question, well, there's a couple questions, but one of them is, well, what are the highest weight elements? Yeah? No. Arbitrary. They can be the same. They can differ by anything. It's completely free. Yeah, I mean, so one thing is I could essentially, well, people often draw their abacuses with the colors going the other way. Is that what your complaint is, what your question is? Where do you see two things wrapping around, though? I mean, so far the rows aren't wrapping around. So far I just have 4 independent rows. They will be in a second, but they don't at the moment. Then you can ask your question again, and then maybe I'll answer it. All right, so then the question is, what are the highest weight elements? So, you know, what is this crystal? Well, fact is there are a lot. In some sense, I will describe, and in particular, for instance, all L cores are going to be highest weight elements. I mean, if all the beads are all the way to the left already, it's the highest weight element. If they're all to the left on their own rows. But what you do see is you get a unique representative of each isomorphism class. Well, that looks like this. You know, all beads to the left of the origin, then just a little bit of stuff to the right, where the stuff to the right fits inside a, well, I'm allowed to take this to be empty for some reason, so an N minus 1 by L box. So, well, that's how these boxes are coming up for now. But before I go on and sort of explain a little bit more of what's going on about these with these highest weight vectors, I want to show you a picture, which is another way of representing this. So, I did not say something. So you might ask, so before asking what all the rest of the highest weight vectors are, you might ask, which configurations show up in the component generated by this highest weight vector? So what up in this? What shows up when you start applying F5s to these? Well, first of all, number of beads on each row must be right. Row must agree. So whatever configuration I get, it must have two more beads to the right on the bottom row than it has blanks to the left. I mean, that's preserved. But then there are two more conditions. They are that it has to be descending and something I call tight. Now, descending is easy to classify. What you do is you connect up the first bead in every row like this. And then it would eventually, you know, after this, it's always going to be this pattern. These lines slope up and to the left. That's what descending means. That condition is preserved by the crystal operators. What the tight condition says is I could shift all of these beads up by one and have this one come over here. So I could replace this partition with actually, I should do this with a different color. So I've shifted each of these three. Well, what have I done? Yeah. I shifted each of these three beads up. And this one, I shifted it up, but it got out the top, so it comes in the bottom, but shifted by n. So now a second sort of affine thing is happening. So now you're right. The crystal operators can't tell if you do that. So tight means as far, everything is as far to the left as you can make it by, well, doing the inverse of this type of operation. So you just push all the beads down. If one goes out the bottom, it comes in one to the left. If you can do that without hitting the previous strands, that's illegal. So it has to be one where you can't do that. And, well, the theorem is that's exactly what you get. So it's exactly that set. And here's a picture of that set, if I can figure out how to turn this on. Yeah. It looked good for a second. Okay. Is that visible? So when you have, so here's a descending abacus configuration. I've changed n from, I've changed l to 3 and n to 6 because this is the only example of this picture I've ever made. And it's probably the only one I will ever make. But there's a bijection between rows of beads and partitions, which is well known. And what I've done is I've taken the partition for this row, and I have put it along here. So let me draw it so that you can see a partition there. And I need to draw it in the correct location. Yeah, here it is. And if I've drawn that correctly, reading along from the left side, you see white, 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 white. Then you see, well, going up, which I've shaded black, white, black, 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 white, black, white, black, black, white, and so on. It's a partition. And this descending condition is exactly that if you draw these in, shifted the right amounts, they fit inside each other to get a three-dimensional picture like this, which I call a cylindric partition. So, you know, this next one down, I think for some reason, is actually the next one up over here. I had serious trouble with symmetries drawing these pictures. But you get some cylindric picture like this. Now, the tight condition actually is not natural in this picture, or at least not so natural. What it says is that if you color this correctly, basically by what color the each top region, by what type of move you would be doing down here, if you added a box sitting on top of that, you should never see three squares of the same color all at the same height. I don't know. That's not so natural. But what is true is if you use all of these configurations, so all descending ones, which is the same as all cylindric partitions, so just descending naturally is a still for GLN hat. Well, what do I mean by that? GLN hat is essentially FLN hat and a Heisenberg algebra. But I'm claiming that you get these things, you get many copies of the same indecomposable crystal, and that the multiplicities they show up have a natural grading, and that grading is the same as the grading of an irreducible representation for GLN hat broken up into irreducible representations for FLN hat. So for some reason, the fact that this looks nicer is telling me at least that one should be thinking of this as a GLN picture, not an FLN picture. Okay, I guess I'm going to hide this picture again. Make screen blank. Yeah, I'm looking for Chernoff. End presentation, bottom left. Going off. All right, very good. So, well, the next thing I'd promised you was something to do with fusion algebra. So we're interested in these level restricted Littlewood-Richardson coefficients, which are, you know, the same as the Verlinda, the structure constants of the Verlinda algebra. I mean, they've come up in many ways. They also can be approached with K-Schur functions, all kinds of things. But for me, well, I'm going to use the following definition, which the only real source I know of is this paper of Foda, Leclerc, Coccato, and Thibon. But the way you can see this coefficient as the dimension of some Hom space, between some V. Gamma and V lambda tensor some evaluation representation at some point of classical weight corresponding to mu. And, well, I need to put some sort of funniness over this tensor product, which means just that you're going to take some completion here. So then you look at this and you say, well, taking the tensor product of a affine represent, well, these are just two representations of SLN hat. I would like to use my combinatorial theory to do this, which is I would like to, use crystal basis. And this works, well, precisely when this module has a crystal basis, which is precisely when mu is a rectangle. So this is how you get combinatorial rule for these in the case where mu is a rectangle. I'm not going to even explicitly write it down. If you know how to take tensor product of crystals, it's very simple. Use whatever rule you know for taking tensor products of crystals. This crystal is going to be indexed by some set, and what you're going to be counting to get this coefficient is those things that satisfy the condition that this is highest weight, which I think is actually simpler than any rule I could write down. And just to point out, you know, this does in particular give you all Pierre rules. I mean, I can do any rectangle, which means I can do multiplication by the EIs or by the HIs, and I can actually see quite a lot. And in fact, here's something you can see, which will, to some extent, answer this question about why are there two affine things going on here. So I need the picture back. So here's the highest weight element. For SL3 of level 4, and I'm just going to draw more of these dots so we can see a little bit more about what's going on. And why I want to do that? Well, I want to do that because I want to say I've chosen this so there's dots everywhere out here and blanks everywhere out here. All I really have is this square, and I can read it as an N by L rectangle or an L by N rectangle, which in this sort of notation is saying let's just, you know, move all these extra beads down here instead of there and just look at this window of the picture. Now I see an N by L rectangle, which is the highest weight vector for, well, not SLN at level L, but SLL at level N. And you start thinking about the Pierre rules, and what you find is multiplying, you know, in this picture by sort of any column. Once you do this and do your affine transformation, it's like multiplying by a row. So you see, I mean, this is what's known as rank level duality. You see that the fusion algebra of GLN at level L is the same as the fusion algebra of GLL at level N, and the isomorphism is the one that interchanges the Pierre rules. You notice I said GL instead of SL, and that's because, in this case, for some reason, you get an isomorphism class by taking an n minus 1 by L rectangle. You can get all types of SLN highest weights this way. Well, if I was going to do that here, I would want to take a L minus 1 by N rectangle, which is slightly different. And the way you get these to actually match up exactly is you don't insist that the partitions lie in an N minus 1 by L box, and in fact, you don't insist that they lie in any box. You allow, like, much bigger things, like this. So you have this condition. You insist on this condition, which we should be used to, the length of the pieces don't, the length of the top and bottom piece don't differ too much, but you don't impose any other condition. And you can see that this duality still works. I would just move these beads above. And so somehow you need a way to record the number of beads as well as the isomorphism class as a representation for SLN hat. And it's somehow reasonably clear that recording it as a representation of GLN hat will do that. Essentially, how the identity acts is going to tell you how many beads you have. So then it works exactly. Okay, so that's sort of the end of part one. So, all right. Yeah, I didn't actually put any follow-up to that other than that we're interested in it, but I guess I explained it. Okay, so I don't quite know how necessary this is, because as I said, I think some authors do understand this fine, and it is reasonably precise. So I'm going to tell you, you know, I've told you that essentially you just need to record the number of beads, but these constructions of the Verlinde algebra are, you know, using this evaluation representations or else. Well, the one I like is using quantum groups. So essentially, I'm going to take this as an excuse to tell you the construction I like using quantum groups, which, you know, works for, when G is complex simple algebra, like the finite type case, and then how to modify that case in a precise way to get a category that gives you exactly this fusion algebra where this duality holds exactly. And in fact, you can see other symmetries you're supposed to see in this fusion algebra exactly. Also, it will match quantum cohomology exactly, and you don't have any of these trouble. So, I guess this was, I titled this bit of the talk, Verlinde algebra as a semi-simplified fusion. And as I said, this is the fact that this is equivalent to the standard definitions is due to Finkelberg, although using very strongly a lot of works of Kazan and Lustig. So maybe all three names should go there. And I'm not going to tell you why it's equivalent to the standard definition. I'm just going to tell you this definition. So we're going to work in the quantum group for, well, let's first do SLN before we do GLN. Where epsilon is primitive. Two L root one. And this, the fact that it's 2N plus 2L instead of N plus L is very annoying. This is simply the fact that the quantum N is always divisible by the 2nth cyclotomic polynomial. And this is just how quantum groups were set up. It's sort of unnecessary. If L is odd, if n plus L is odd, you don't even need these 2s, and it all works normally. But when it's even, you need the 2s. Okay, so what is this quantum group? Well, I mean, you have, in UQ, you have these generators you may have seen which are called Fs and Es and Ks, where the E's and F's are the generalization of the E's and F's I talked about for SL3, and K looks like Q to the HI, roughly, where Q is your parameter. But for this, because we want to specialize, we actually need to be a little bit more careful. We're going to put in generators called FI with round brackets N for all N, where this is, well, essentially is Fi to the n over quantum n factorial, where this quantum n is calculated with respect to this e. Now, the reason I sort of put this in parentheses is, you know, this will be zero if n is large. And I'm just saying this has to be in the algebra. This actually forces Fi to the n also to be zero. So this is zero and this is zero, but I don't know if that makes sense, but you take this thing generated by these, and then we're going to quotient it at epsilon equals 1, if you want to be formal. And also, you want to have the ei to the n, and you also put in the ki All right. So that's the algebra. I'm going to need this board again, so let me move slightly safer. All right, and so we want to construct a fusion algebra, so we need some category, which should be semi-simple category, and the objects are going to be modules for this. I guess currently SL with. Wait. For all positive roots, you have this inequality. Well, I mean, for SL n, this means partitions in and do I want it? Yeah, that's right. For SLN, this is partitions in the N by L box. So this is just a formal definition that generalizes, but it's just the highest weights here are partitions, the ones where lambda 1 minus lambda N is, well, lambda N is 0, I guess, since it's SLN, so lambda 1 is less than L. These are the ones we want. Okay. Now we want, well, I want just a category where I can, I mean, I guess I should tell you what the tensor product is. Well, what you do is you take the normal tensor product, and then you just throw away any indecomposable pieces with highest weight outside with so we'll call this thing CL equals the set of all lambda such that this holds. What you do is you take the ordinary tensor product. What you get is, well, it's a sum of indecomposables in some way. If you see any indecomposable that has any, I mean, it may have pieces both in and outside this alcove, but throw it away anyway. I mean, throw all of it away. What you get is some well-defined rule. And that is equivalent to the normal fusion rule for the Veland algebra. Well, we now just want some way to make this rule work for GLN. And I mean, the trick is essentially just to define what U epsilon GLN is, and then the GLN alcove will be the alcove of things that, well, look like they sit in here for the SLN. The U epsilon SLN sub U epsilon GLN. And what you want to do is, well, you remember that KI equals Q to the HI, where HI is sort of, well, I mean, HI is, the thing that's 1 minus 1 and then zeros. So it's sort of clear what we should do. We should introduce something which is Q to the, well, this and Q to the this. So Li equals Q to the, well, EII, so that Ki equals Li plus 1 inverse. And we throw those into the algebra, But actually, that's not quite enough. And the reason is throwing this in, because I really shouldn't have a Q there, I should have an epsilon. Li acts on any weight space, as epsilon to some power. In particular, it can't tell if you shift weight spaces by a multiple of 2n plus 2l. And so what you do is you have to introduce some strange things called, some product that looks like it's some divided power, much like this was a divided power, and once you throw that in, you're fine. And I don't know. I don't really think I should say more about that. It just works. And the reason you don't see this, the fact that you need to do this for SLN, is once you've thrown these guys in, it forces the divided power, like this sort of guy for the k's is forced to be there. But you actually have to put it in by hand by the GL to the GL, and then it's done. So I don't know. Perhaps that's one reason. I mean, I actually haven't seen this. Well, I mean, Arun Ram and I wrote it down carefully, but I hadn't really seen this written down super, super carefully before in the GLN case. So perhaps that's a reason to say it wasn't that rigorously defined mathematically, although this is all it is, so. So, yeah. All right, so I just have... That's very close to the end of the talk, but I've actually only been talking for 45 minutes, so I'm going to tell you one more neat little fact, and then I'm going to be done. And the neat fact is, I mean, I got it from this Sherpa and Korf paper, essentially, what it is you can see. You can see these fusion coefficients by multiplying together Schur polynomials and some non-commutative variables, and it's somehow a very neat construction. So here's how it works. You identify partitions lambda which fit in a 4x3 box. Again, I'm always going to do this example. And I think I want to do this example this time. So, and you remember this bijection between partitions and rows of beads I told you before, but you just read it cyclically. So I'm going to draw beads on a circle where the circle will have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 places. And I'm going to put a bead for every space I see vertical. So let's label these 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I'm going to put beads at 1, 4, 5. And you define variables which are operators on configurations of beads like this, which move a bead in position I to a bead in position I plus 1, if possible. And you can define, and I mean, these variables don't commute, if it's not possible, this sends it to 0. So this is some sort of non-commutative algebra. But you can define the notion of Schur polynomials in this algebra, essentially because you can make sense of what the elementary, what the polynomial corresponding to a row should be, and you notice that those commute, and then you're doing fine. And calculating these fusion rules can be interpreted as the Littlewood Richardson rules for multiplying this type of sheer polynomial. But since this isn't really my work at all, I mean, in any guise whatsoever, and we're actually past 4:30, I think I should probably stop and not explain this in detail and just tell you it's a neat picture. Okay, thank you. Oh, yeah, I forgot to say the part of a quantum cohomology. Yeah, that's a good point. this is a well-known fact that the quantum cohomology is the same as the fusion ring. And you prove it essentially by checking that the Pierre rules are the same. I mean, the Schubert class is corresponding to rectangles and... in the fusion ring, this irreducible is corresponding to these rectangles. And it's essentially trivial to see that the fusion rules in both cases is, if you want to multiply by a rectangle of size R, what you do get is all ways of adding, beads in an R strip, R vertical or horizontal strip, so only one on each row, such that what you get in the end is still a partition in a box. I mean, it might be a shifted partition in a box. I might add a bead both here and here, for instance. But it's essentially trivial once you know that you should do it by just checking Jerry rules. And it's essentially done in, among other places, this paper of Korff and Stropel. They just do it using U epsilon SLN instead of GLN. And so then, of course, what they see is a quotient. You can't see the determinant representation. But, I mean, the proof is identical to their proof, so you can look there. Or you can just calculate the Pierre rules yourself, and you'll know it's true.
And the thing that you mentioned is you can use the crystal structure to find the future coefficients in a more rectangular
situation. Is that true? No. I haven't read this FLOT paper carefully enough yet, but I think it's in there. I think they essentially say it in there. No, I mean, essentially just because there's no crystal for the evaluation representation. I mean, and I think this is somehow, finding these fusion coefficients in general has been a very hard question. I think this is somehow one way to see why it's hard. Like, all the normal rules can be interpreted as crystal rules, and there simply is not a crystal basis for those evaluation representations. Yeah, no, they kind of deal with that in that paper. I mean, you have to check that it still works, but it does still work. I mean, you have to check that, the thing you think should be a crystal basis actually somehow, I mean, actually the tensor product of a crystal basis element for this and this is not actually it isn't in any highest weight element, but then you need to do some checking. It is a little bit of work, but the crystal theory does go through. Yeah?
So if you take one of the highest weight index by the amount of partitions and what the module is generated under the crystal operator,
No, I don't think so. First, it's infinite. You get an infinite number of things.
But is there a way to break up into classes?
Yeah, of course, people have asked me this many times, because I have, I even have ribbons showing up in this picture. And, how do you, can you prove this positivity thing in this way? I don't know. I've never been able to do it. It's, of course, a good question. Yeah.
Okay.
questions, thank the speaker again. We may resume tomorrow then at 9:30.
Yeah.
Do you have a minute to talk?
Yeah, definitely. I'm just going to... Yeah.
So, the binomials in K-sure functions correspond to K-tableau.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen that.
Yeah, like this ribbon tableau. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's K-sure, the dual K-sures are...
Yeah. Oh, sorry, you want to do these core...
And have a crystal whose character is behavior.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, you would want it. That's right. You would want a an FLN crystal.
Right.
Whereas
would not be an affine.
Yeah, and then but it, of course you could hope that you could cut out a piece in the affine. I mean,
yeah,
affine
exactly.
Crystal is in particular an FLN crystal, so it's not crazy, but.
And I might know how to do it.
Oh, no, that's interesting, because I don't know how to do it.
No, that's not how it is. Would I...
But if you specify the lambda, then that's already...
Yeah, and so my crystal is an infinite crystal.
Then it's already, determined as an infinite crystal.
Well, but...
Because then you have a highest weight.
But that's not the one I want.
So it's not the highest weight system.
Well, so am I.
Because if you specify a lambda and you want an SLM.
Right, I understand that you get the irreducible thing.
Right.
Irreducible things, and that's not what I have. What we think we have, and there's a lot to check still, but it seems promising, is... There's a unique highest weight K-tableau. So if your K-bounded partition is...
So by K-tableau, you mean
weak K-tableau. Mm-hmm. So your partition is 2 to 1.
Yeah.
And
is that
we...
What we do? No, we tried to do
it. We think we have operators on K-tableau.
Okay.
Called the EI and FI,
mm-hmm.
which do exactly what you expect them to do on the weight.
Okay.
And are the inverse of each other, and the orbit of them is all the K-tableau of that
shape. Okay. So your shape will actually now be
the core.
Okay.
Yeah, core.
Right.
And then the operators. It's exactly like
the
operators, but they act on K-tableau.
Right. So I don't know exactly,
but
like
what,
the,
but
K,
what is
the usual operators is maybe too much
but
to say.
But how do you now find the weight? The way you define the weight?
Yeah.
Not
right.
The number.
Same as
that. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Not,
so
not the number.
So the polynomial you get is a dual K-sure function.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Good.
And then you can just take the skew.
Well, so
skip
that step.
But I'm still confused if you say it's an SLN crystal because
I don't think.
I mean, if it's an SLN crystal, it can't be irreducible.
Right, no,
I mean, it's the wrong size.
Right. It's not. It can't be an SLN crystal. That's
well, I mean,
okay.
You'd actually like to show it is an SLN crystal, just not irreducible, right?
No. In fact,
these are the dual.
Oh, the dual.
Sure,
okay, fine.
They're smaller than.
Yeah. Okay.
They're smaller than a sure.
So what
okay.
we. What I don't understand. So all I know is that.
So you have E1 up to EN. You have.
Up to N minus 1.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you have that many.
And.
But then you see, Stenberg, he already classified that.
Right, so we must not satisfy one of Stenberg's exact.
So is it the regular crystal what you get?
Like what is regular?
So if you take out any.
Okay.
But I will use that to
do. Yeah, I keep forgetting to check what days are apartment 3.
Okay.
I think it's from the 9th.
Okay.
I think Renee is leaving on the 9th, but send me email, because if I remember to check when Emily's in the room, I should be able to find out.
Okay.
Yeah, at very least I can get Emily to then email the person who is staying, and then we'll know. Yeah, definitely. I'll see you in a minute.
I have copies of the original things I made, the transparency stuff anyway, so it's fine.
That do exactly what we want to do, right, which is act on the weights and glue the whole thing associated with the highest weight together. This idea of what representations have these sorts of characters,
right,
is a mysterious question.
Yeah.
This is sort of a step towards answering that.
Right.
We've got these EIs and FIs that's sort of telling us what's going on. But we don't really know a lot about the right context in which to understand this.
I see.
That's sort of
I
a
see.
Question.
Okay.
Consequence of this would be
that
we would get all the fusion.
Yeah.
But one thing, so can you take
sense
of that?
We can take.
You would do the skew. You would just take the skew shapes and then everything with the highest.
I mean,
like the usual Littlewood Richardson rule is look at skew tableau and that has Yamanuchi or highest weight content. And now we can define highest weight content.
And any of those are the
core.
The number of highest weight.
So yeah, you should maybe show me how this works. If you had
it's very preliminary at this point.
But you're doing. Yeah, I don't really understand this dual side that well.
Well, I mean, you can think of it as a co-product of the other, if you understand the other one.
It might.
I mean, if you think of the usual Littlewood Richardson's as this.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Uh-huh.
I mean, of course, that's the same as looking at that, except for us it isn't the same because we don't have the self-duality. So to get this expansion for dual, it amounts to the usual K expansion for this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's just exactly the Hall dual to the usual picture.
Okay.
Yeah, these are dual.
Yeah.
these are exactly the same as the product of